Hello, I'm Marc Latendresse. This is number 0207, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Older, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Older.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0207. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, legendary comic actress Rose Marie, best known for playing Sally Rogers on The Dick Van Dyke Show. She's been performing since she was 3.
I won an amateur contest when I was 3. I sounded the same way I sound today. I sang the way I sing today. And everybody said, "That's not a child, that's a 35-year-old midget."
Zore Garamani is the author of The Moon Daughter, a novel that takes place in her native Iran.
It begins with a childbirth, and this woman is married to a man in the army who demands sons from the beginning, and she has already given him 2 daughters, and this is her 3rd child. Not only does this child turn out to be a daughter, but also she has a birth defect. So that sets the events of the book in motion.
Patrick Mahaney is a certified veterinary acupuncturist. Is it difficult to perform acupuncture on a pet?
It's a different game, so to speak, because the person goes into their acupuncture appointment and is willing to receive the kind of calming or stimulating effects of needle placement. And animals don't necessarily recognize that that's something that's going to potentially help them. And with dogs and cats, you have to approach them in a way where you're going to calm them down and then achieve your effect by needle placement. Or actually, I do quite a bit of laser treatment now, laser acupuncture, so I can even place fewer needles and I can still have a beneficial effect without creating undesirable stimulation just by having needle go into tissue.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0207, was Marc Letendresse, who is a cameraman at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. Thank you very much, Marc, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, firefighters in England have a big problem on their hands after having to free hundreds of people with body parts trapped in household objects, including a man whose penis was stuck in a toaster. Yes. The London Fire Brigade says crews have attended over 1,300 incidents since 2010 involving people being trapped or stuck in everyday household items, including 79 people locked in handcuffs. The brigade speculated the popularity of the erotic novel 50 Shades of Grey may account for the rise in the handcuff use. Some of the incidents our firefighters are called out to could be prevented with a little common sense, said Dave Brown, third officer of the brigade, in a press release. I'm sure more people will be 50 shades of red by the time our crews arrive to free them. In the last 3 years, the capital's fire crews have been called out to 18 incidents involving children with their heads stuck in potties or toilet seats, 5 incidents involving people's hands being stuck in shredders, 79 incidents involving people being trapped in handcuffs, 9 instances of men with rings stuck around their penises, 4 situations where people had their hands stuck in blenders, and 17 incidents involving children with their fingers stuck in toys, including one with Lego stuck on his finger. See, there's never really a dull moment when you work for the London Fire Brigade. Anyway, residents of Altınyeva, Turkey, discovered a small kestrel falcon and grew suspicious when they saw a small metallic ring around its leg with a stamp reading 24311 Tel Aviv, Uana, Israel. They turned it in to the local authorities, who identified the bird by the name Israel Ejan, Israeli agent, or spy. Government officials subjected the bird to medical exams and x-rays to ensure that there were no hidden microchips. Putting metal bands on birds is a common ornithological practice to help scientists track migration, officials cleared the bird of espionage and decided to release it without pressing charges. And they haven't heard a peep out of that alleged spy since. Yeah. You know, the bird is a bird, but the people who found the bird, they're bird brains. Okay, speaking of bird brains, over the last 6 months, the Indian Army documented 329 sightings of two unidentified objects seen flying over Pangong Tso, a high-altitude lake lying across the border between India and Tibet. They also believe the objects violated the line of actual control, which India shares with China 155 times. Now, fearing China was using drones to spy on them, officials chartered the Indian Institute of Astrophysics in Bangalore to look at the objects and determine their origin. Astronomers were able to quickly identify the drones as the planets Jupiter and Venus. Wow. Let's wait and see if India dispatches teams of soldiers to the planets to make sure there are no spies there. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In 2009, doctors at St. Joseph's Hospital Health Center in Syracuse, New York, were about to remove organs for transplant from Colleen S. Burns, age 41, who had been declared dead after a drug overdose. Before they could cut her open, she woke up and was far from dead. A nurse had even told the doctors that Burns' condition was improving. Yeah, well, you know, when somebody's been declared dead, any kind of activity is far more than just improving. Improving is like an understatement. Anyway, the New York Health Department conducted a lengthy investigation over the incident in part because the hospital didn't do one. The state, not surprisingly, found the hospital's level of care unacceptable. The health department fined the hospital $6,000 and ordered the hospital to bring in a neurologist to teach doctors how to accurately diagnose brain death. Yeah. Okay, it's obviously deplorable that a hospital apparently can't properly tell if someone's actually dead. But isn't there another point here that everybody is missing? I mean, who wants organs from someone who was a drug addict? A lifetime of illicit chemicals can't be helpful to those parts. I'm just asking. Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Entertainment legend Rose Marie is celebrating a milestone birthday on August 15th. She is going to turn 90. And by the way, in lieu of presents to celebrate, Rose would like people to send a donation to the Doris Day Animal Foundation. Rose is on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Rose.
Hi, dear. How are you?
I'm fine. Happy birthday to you.
Well, it isn't for the 15th.
Well, you're about to
last that long.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. You're about to hit a milestone, and you've had such an illustrious career. In your estimation, what has been your career highlight? Because you've done so many things.
Oh, I can't give you one thing. There were so many wonderful things happening to me. First of all, let me tell you about the Doris Day Foundation. Doris and I worked together in her show, her television show. We became very good friends, very close. We talked to one another every once in a while. And I thought, for my birthday, what's better than to save some animals? And her foundation is the greatest one of all because they take care of the animals. They don't kill them. They don't send them to any laboratories. And I thought, well, why not? So I called Doris and I said, how would you like to have me donate everything that I am to your foundation? And she said, oh, that would be wonderful. And she wrote a wonderful little script to put on the internet or fax machine or whatever you call it, Facebook or whatever. I don't know. I don't have the computer. But she has been just wonderful, and I hope this thing is good because the foundation is wonderful, and I'm doing it basically for the foundation and for Doris.
Excellent. Now, do you have big plans for your birthday? Do you have a big party planned?
Party? No party. Not because I have to invite too many people. Well, I think I'm just going to go out to dinner with my daughter and her husband.
Excellent, excellent. Now, you said you had so many highlights in your career. Of course, you worked on the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was a classic television series in the early 60s. Lightning doesn't usually strike twice, but as you said, you had another long run working with Doris Day on her show.
Yeah.
What was it like working with Doris?
Absolutely the greatest. She was the most wonderful. She is the most wonderful person. And the way you see her is exactly the way she is. She's sweet and wonderful and lovable. And we got along just great. And we were very funny with one another. In fact, when I called her, she said, "I miss the fun we had," you know. We talked to one another every once in a while. And she said, "I miss the fun that we had," because we laughed all the time. She's the most wonderful, underrated actress that ever happened. Mm. Nobody gives her credit for how good she is.
You know, we often talk when we look back in television and we look at working women portrayed in TV. We often talk about Mary Tyler Moore and her breakthrough television show when she did the Mary Tyler Moore Show. But before she became a working woman, you were a working woman.
Oh, I was the first lady. I had an equal job with the boys. I made the same money. I was treated as one of the boys. I was the first woman to be like that, you know, in the country.
A lot is often made about being the first and breaking through the glass ceiling. Did you ever feel any pressure in succeeding in the character that you played on the Dick Van Dyke Show?
Never. Everybody just thought it was very funny. I get mail from 15, 16 years old, 14 years old, telling me how wonderful I am on the Dick Van Dyke Show. They all watch the reruns, and they say, "It's too bad television isn't that good today." And these are kids that are 13 and 14 and 12, and I'm amazed that they know the difference. They say, "We wish they had more of the Dick Van Dyke type of shows."
The character you play, the quick-witted comedy writer Sally Rogers, how close was Sally Rogers to Rosemarie?
Same one.
Really?
Same one. I just played me.
How did you get the role?
Very easy. No, I can't say it was easy. I used to do a nightclub act around the country, and I used to play the flamingo. I opened the flamingo in 1938, I think it was, for Bugsy Siegel. And I used to play Vegas 5-6 times a year before it was a desert. And everybody knew that I played the flamingo so many times. And I must go back. Danny Thomas was a hot flash comic in Chicago and was coming to New York as the new White Hope as a comedy. I opened for him at the Martinique in New York. We became very good friends. When he came out here to California, he had his radio show and television show, and I kept saying to him, "When am I going to do your show? You have everybody on the show but me, and we're friends, we're like family, and you have everybody but me." And he always used to say, "Your time will come, your time will come." And one day, I got a call from the casting office, and they said, "Go down to Desi Lou, Danny Thomas." I said, "Oh, I finally got the guest shot." She said, "No, this is for a new show called The Dick Van Dyke Show." I said, "What's a Dick Van Dyke?" And she said, "Just go down there." So I met Carl Reiner for the first time, and Sheldon Leonard, who was also the producer, he said to Carl, he said, "If you want the best, get Rosemarie." I didn't read. I didn't have to do anything. The part was mine the minute I walked in. And when I said, "Who did that for the third writer?" They said, "We haven't cast him yet." And I said, "What about Maury Amsterdam?" I said, "Everybody in show business knows him. He's one of the greatest writers that ever happened. He wrote to Fanny Bryce and Fred Allen and people like that." And then I guess he decided to become a comic himself. But nobody in the world knew Maury Amsterdam. Just show people. So I said, "Get Maury, he'd be just great." They said, "You have his number?" And I said, "Yes." And I gave it to him because Maury and I have been friends since I was 11 years old. Maury used to write all my material for my nightclub act. And I'm his daughter's godmother. So we were very close. I called him up and I said, they're going to offer you a show called the Dick Van Dyke Show. He says, what's a Dick Van Dyke? I said, I don't know, but we're going to do it. And he says, I'll be out Monday. I said, fine. And that's how he got the part. And that's how I got the part.
You mentioned he was writing for you since you were 11 years old. You actually started on stage at the age of 3, correct?
That's right.
So you've had a very long career.
I won an amateur contest when I was 3. I sounded the same way I sound today. I sang the way I sing today. And everybody said, that's not a child, that's a 35-year-old midget. So I had to go on a tour of the latter part of vaudeville to prove that I was a child, because everybody thought I was a midget. I had my own radio show when I was 5 years old, coast to coast on NBC, and a 15-minute program on Sunday morning with a piano player and an announcer, and me, and I sang 2 or 3 songs, and that's when people wrote in and said, that's not a child. That's got to be a midget. She sounds too old to be a child. So NBC was affiliated with RKO, and so I did all the RKO theaters across the country for a year to prove I was a child.
Wow, very impressive. Now, again, going back...
I can't talk, right?
Absolutely. Going back to the Dick Van Dyke Show, the show ran for 5 years, and it was still very, very popular when it went off the air.
We could have gone 2 more years at least, because we were never in color.
Was it bittersweet when the show went off the air?
Oh, everybody was very sad. Very sad, but I think it was Carl who decided that we sort of ran dry. Because he wrote all the scripts, you know, and he thought that we couldn't go any further. And he said, this is the last year. And everybody said, it's ridiculous. We can go 2 more years. And Sheldon Lennon said, they'd back up the Briggs truck for Dick if he would go, you know. So we didn't do the last 2 years. We did 5 years. 5 years of the happiest time of my life.
With all that you've done and having such a long and illustrious and varied career, was there anything you didn't get the chance to do that you wanted to do?
No, not really. Well, I did plays. I did Top Banana on Broadway, so I can't say that. I played all the nightclubs that were big clubs in town, but like the Copacabana, the Schaeferie, places like that, the Plaza, all the top places I used to play with my act. I did vaudeville as a child. I learned so much from the other acts because they felt sorry for me because I was a kid and they thought that I was lonesome and didn't have anything to do. So they taught me how to juggle. They taught me how to jump on a trampoline. They taught me how to walk on a water ball. They taught me all the things that I know today. It was the greatest education I ever had.
It's been an amazing career and an amazing life. And here you are.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I don't know how it happened. I mean, I never stopped. I just went from one thing to another. Even during the awkward age, which was like 13 or 14, I had a radio show at NBC. And then I opened at the Versailles in New York during a nightclub act. So I played the Roxy. And I, as I said, did Broadway. I mean, I nearly did it all except circus and opera.
Well, I know how it happened, basically. It's just absolute talent. That's basically what it is.
I just went from one to another and never stopped. I never even thought of stopping.
Well, Rose,
I just went on from one thing to the next.
Rose, 90 years young coming up. I wish you a very, very happy birthday coming up. And I thank you.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
I thank you so much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Bye-bye, dear.
Rose Marie. Again, even though she is turning 90 on August 15th, there is no need to send her a gift. But if you'd like to send a donation in her name, you can send it to the Doris Day Animal Foundation, and that would be much appreciated. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0207, and you'll find links to Rose Marie's site and also links to make that direct donation.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to the author of The Moon Daughter. Plus, we'll also have a vet on talking about pet care. And, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news. On a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Yes, have you ever heard the phrase, one good turn deserves another? This does not always apply. Maybe a better philosophy would be in this case, don't bring home stray dogs, especially if you are a paraplegic who likes to sleep in the nude. You know, this story ain't gonna end well, huh? This particular paraplegic apparently had a soft spot in his heart for a small, white, fluffy stray that he had taken in about 3 weeks earlier. The dog repaid the kindness by eating one of his testicles while he slept. Okay, that sentence phrasing might not have been quite perfect, so I just want to make it perfectly clear. The dog did not eat one of its own testicles. It ate the paraplegic's testicle while he slept. Okay. He was awakened by a burning pain in his midsection, according to the initial police report. The 39-year-old man told the police he sleeps in the nude and noticed the dog was between his legs. He also noticed the dog had blood on its muzzle and front feet. When the man looked further, according to the report, he noticed that the dog had eaten one of his testicles. Police took the dog to a local veterinarian where it was euthanized and tested for rabies. The man, in a move that proves the universe has a perverse sense of humor, was taken to St. Bernard's Regional Medical Center where he was treated for his injuries. Yes, St. Bernard's. Yes. Sometimes you feel like a nut. Sometimes you don't. Anyway, a New Hampshire man woke up to the sound of a gunshot only to discover he'd shot himself in the knee while sleepwalking. The gunshot woke the man from a nightmare. The unidentified man was taken to hospital with serious injuries. The man was alone in the house and his wife was at work at the time. Police didn't release the man's name and said he wouldn't be charged because it was an accident. A similar sleepwalking accident took place in Colorado in 2010 when a 63-year-old man awoke to discover he'd shot himself in the knee. You know, personally, I prefer a simple alarm clock. Thank you very much. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, under the headline of news that sounds like a joke, in May, which was before Edward Snowden began releasing his previously classified document cache, the American Civil Liberties Union released its own attempts to learn some of the same information from the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act. Now, two of the documents, totaling 69 pages, were completely redacted. Solid black boxes covering the entirety of every page except for page numbers and document title. You know, one has to ask the question, just how much money does the FBI spend in ink toner? That's what I'd like to know. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Zore Garamani left a thriving dental practice in Chicago and moved her family to San Diego to pursue a writing career, which is going pretty well. Her first book was the acclaimed Sky of Red Poppies, and her new novel is entitled The Moon Daughter. Zore joins us on the line right now from San Diego. Hi, Zore.
Hello, how are you?
Very fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is a story, I understand, takes place around the time of the 70s in Iran, correct? The story, The Moon Daughter?
Yes.
Tell us what it's about.
In this story, this is purely fiction, although like all fictions, I draw my characters out of what I've seen in real life. But I wanted to address a couple of things. One is the strong family ties within Iranian families, and two, the issues that many women in Muslim countries in the Middle East face. I mean, they're global issues, but more so in those countries. And so it begins with a childbirth scene, and this woman is married to a man in the army who demands sons from the beginning, and she has already given him two daughters, and this is her third child. Not only does this child turn out to be a daughter, but also she has a physical defect, a birth defect. So that sets the events of the book in motion. But through the story of this woman, I have tried to portray many of the lives similar to hers in Iran. And the book is in two parts. Part one is told in third person, and it's the mother's story. Part two is in first person, and it's the daughter, who is an American-raised adult, a lawyer, no less, who wants to go back and look at those laws that affected her mother's destiny.
Now, as they always say when it comes to writers, you write what you know. You yourself are originally from Iran, correct?
Yes.
Who do you primarily see as your audience for your book when you're writing?
People with feeling, people who are interested in human emotions. I do write them from what I know, but I don't target primarily Iranian audience. This is a global issue, a mother-daughter issue. Many other immigrants' issues are also reflected. The cultural difference between the daughter and the mother is not unlike what I know between my own daughters and myself. And how families deal with it, how do different people face such problems? But all in all, I hope that while the book does have something substantial to say, it is, as my readers so far tell me, a page-turner, an entertaining education about another culture, and just a story that each reader finds a little bit of it very close to their own heart.
Well, and the only thing an author can hope for is definitely a page-turner, and you definitely have that. You have daughters, as you mentioned, and obviously the background of some of the characters is similar to your background. What do your daughters say about the book?
They, of course, like my writing, and or at least they say so. I don't know. They wouldn't tell their mother they don't like it. In writing, we always say, don't ask the family's opinion, because the family always praises and, you know, oohs and ahs about no matter what you do. If they love you, they like your work. But I think that what they see more, and my son as well, what they see is parts of culture that they haven't been open to. Because when we live here, we live very much a Western life. True that we have our occasional Persian food and we celebrate Persian New Year and try to keep the culture alive, but we go with the flow very much, and Iranians in particular do a lot of that. They blend in with the society or try to. My children have not been exposed to my culture except through the book in such an intimate way, and they seem to enjoy that. They seem to learn a lot from it.
We've seen recently, and sadly, I would have to say, certain narrow-mindedness. What comes to mind, the recent interview, for instance, that was on Fox News with Reza Aslan about his book Zealot. Just the mindset behind what took place in that interview. The idea that someone who lives in the United States has adopted the American culture and is quite happy where they're living, can still be objectified based on a background of where they're from. Does that ever come into play when you sit down to write these stories?
Not really. I try to separate my personal feelings and personal experiences from what I am writing. When I write, I get under the skin of characters, and that is why sometimes I can get quite emotional while I'm writing something that's completely unrelated to me or my experience, such as in this book. But I do see the stereotype, and I did watch that interview at least two or three times, and I must say I admire him for being so cool about it, because anyone else would have just been shown how aggravated they are. So he was very patient and tried to show that. Stereotyping will never be out of our daily lives. Today it's the Iranians, tomorrow it will be somebody else. 30 years ago it was the Russians, the Germans, the Japanese. Today it's the Middle East people. This is politics. I think that we all need to rise a step above that. And I'm glad that many book readers do that. The mere fact that they pick up a book from an unknown author with an unpronounceable name, such as mine, and they read it, is testimony to the fact that they are open-minded, that they do want to learn. And I don't target it for a certain audience, but I am glad that the majority of people who read my book, and especially those who like it, are people who I personally like and I consider intellectual, open-minded. So if there is someone who, because this is Iranian issues and I happen to be born and raised in Iran, they're not going to give that book a chance, I'm not so sure that's so bad. Well, because that's not the kind of reader you would want.
You mentioned the emotional toll of writing a story like this. What is the writing process for you like? And by that I mean, do you know when you're sitting down to write a story like The Moon Daughter, do you know the beginning, middle, and end of the story before you start to write? Or do you learn about the characters and learn the story as you write?
I know I have a sort of basis for the story. So I begin thinking I know the end. And I'm often surprised at how, when you develop your characters as strongly as some of these are, they kind of go their own way. And then you suddenly see that the ending that you had in mind doesn't go with, you know, Rana doesn't want to do what I originally wanted her to do, or Yalda doesn't do what I thought she would do, because then they have a personality of their own. So I try not to set my heart into the ending and sort of keep an open mind about that and see what happens. But I do have an idea of what I want to say. And most of the stories that I write, be it in Persian or English, are stories within me that I have carried for years and wanted to write them, and I just sit down and do it. Because if I don't tell these stories, who will? Nobody else is in my mind. Everybody has their own stories. And if we can tell them in a fashion that the reader understands, enjoys, and gets into it, it's a picture that will never fade.
When you write, when you see the finished product, do you consciously or subconsciously see either yourself or other family members hidden within the characters?
Parts of me are always emotionally there, but as far as the description of characters, I think with my first book, I was partly the narrator, but in this book, no, I don't see myself in it at all. But I do see my daughters, if their destiny had been different than the peaceful one that it is, if they had been in that sort of situation. And actually, for the Yalda part of it, I even interviewed my daughter to see how she saw my culture from outside. Not that I used everything that she said. I sort of used my own imagination and information from other people. But I always have someone to model somebody after. So I have this funny cup that says, be careful, you could end up in my next novel.
Now, I just have about a minute. I just have to ask, since I mentioned in the introduction, you left a thriving dental practice in Chicago, moved to San Diego to pursue a writing career. What made you make that leap?
I had always been writing. And one day I heard on the radio, if there's something you've always wanted to do, do it. And I thought, okay, when I was young, I was pushed to become a dentist. Then I had an education and I wanted to work with it. Who's pushing me now? And that was the day that I put an ad to sell my practice. And of course, Northwestern University, where I was teaching, was going, and I was teaching only part-time, but they were going to close the dental school anyway. So that was another good excuse. And I thought, this is the time when you make your U-turn and live your life as you want it to, because nobody's pushing you to get up in the morning and go to your practice and drill, fill, and bill. So there you go. I decided, and lucky for me, my family supported me, and I have to tell you, it is the best decision I have ever made.
Well, dentistry's loss is literature's gain. So the book is called The Moon Daughter. It's written by Zore Garamani. And Zore, I thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for calling. And I really appreciate it. It's an honor to talk to you.
Zore Garamani, author of The Moon Daughter. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0207, and you'll find links to Zore's site, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. With about 1 month left of summer vacation for most kids, many parents are looking for things they can do with the family before school starts again. Well, I have an idea that was suggested to me recently by a college professor. But don't worry, kids, it has nothing to do with studying. It's a factory tour. Have you ever wondered how the stripes get into candy canes? Or how computer chips are made? Maybe you'd rather see how potato chips are made. There are factory tours for all of these things. Now, if you've heard me on the radio before, you might have guessed that lawsuits would somehow figure into this story. And you'd be right. That college professor also told me that many factories are discontinuing their tours because of fears over lawsuits. Let's be fair, it doesn't take a PhD to know that lawsuits are changing America. Many of these fun and educational tours may soon be gone. So don't delay. Take time this summer for a factory tour. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to a veterinarian. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Okay, we often hear stories of people whom, after a few too many drinks, decide to do something they later regret. Usually, it is something juvenile and stupid, but every now and then, something life-threateningly stupid is attempted, like the stunt pulled off by this man. 47-year-old John Murillo wanted to prove that he could swim across the Detroit River from Canada to the U.S. after a night of drinking. "I was drinking, but I wasn't really drunk," Murillo of Windsor said. "The thing is, I've been telling people I'm going to swim across the river for years, and they're like, yeah, yeah, blah, blah, you can't make it. So, I don't know, last night I just decided it was time to go." Murillo said he regrets causing problems for authorities, including Windsor police, the Coast Guard crews from the U.S. and Canada. Three boats and a helicopter responded. "As soon as I saw the helicopters going by and the boats looking for me, I was like, uh-oh, this is really stupid," Murillo said. The incredible thing is, Murillo actually made it across to Detroit, getting out of the water near downtown's Renaissance Center. He was swimming back when he was found by the U.S. Coast Guard. During his stop on the Detroit side of the river, he said people wanted to take his picture. He will likely be fined for swimming in the shipping channel, which could be a fine of anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000. Oh, sure, he made it, but now, just wait. There will be copycats, and I'll bet someone won't make it. Call it a future Darwin File candidate. And speaking of Darwin File, oh, we have one for you right now. Talk about a segue. You know, it is time for the Darwin File because the tree of life is often self-pruning. Kentucky State Police are investigating the death of a Rowan County man. Police said that Richard Jones, age 52, died after an explosion on his front porch. Police say Jones's oxygen tank exploded. Investigators say preliminary information indicates Jones was smoking a cigarette at the time. His family says he has had three prior explosions at his home for the very same reason. But this one was different because, well, it killed him. The mobile home in the Clearfield community went up in flames. State police say someone passing through noticed the fire and ran to get help from a neighbor who happened to be Jones's sister and her husband, Brent Parker. They live just three doors down from Jones. The family says they are shocked that Jones is dead, but not how he died. They'd always told him not to smoke around his oxygen tank. Well, we've always said smoking kills. So does stupidity. When you put the two together, that's quite a cocktail. I didn't make this guy the idiot of the day, but that does come later on in the program. In the meantime, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Patrick Mahaney is a certified veterinary acupuncturist and a certified veterinary journalist with California Pet Acupuncture and Wellness Incorporated in Los Angeles. He combines traditional veterinary practices with Eastern wisdom, and Patrick also has a national pet care column. He joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Peter. It's great to be back again.
Nice to talk to you once again. First of all, let's start off and talk about how what you do as a vet is different. I mentioned acupuncturist. How it is, what you do different from, say, traditional vets?
Sure. Well, what I try to do is I integrate theories of both Western medicine and Eastern philosophies like traditional Chinese veterinary medicine. And by looking at disease in terms of where it potentially comes from on a deeper level besides just like you got a bacteria, you got a virus, you're sick. Like, why is your immune system down and therefore you're more susceptible to diseases? I'm really able to kind of take a different approach to my patient's health, and I'm able to actually even see more by going to my client's home to evaluate what's exactly going on in the household or in the yard that could be contributing to a pet's current state of illness or keeping them well.
Now, you use acupuncture, and I have to ask, is it difficult to use acupuncture with a dog? And the reason why I bring that up is, you know, with a human being, you can explain to a person what you're doing and how the needles work, but you really can't explain it to a dog. How do you keep it calm to put in the needles?
Well, a dog or a cat, actually. Those are the two primary species that I work on. And you're absolutely right. It is, it's a different game, so to speak, because the person goes into their acupuncture appointment and is willing to receive the kind of calming or stimulating effects of needle placement. And animals don't necessarily recognize that that's something that's going to potentially help them. And I mean, when somebody comes up and pinches you in the side, it's an undesirable stimulus and you bat their hand away or you move away. With dogs and cats, you have to approach them in a way where you're going to calm them down and then achieve your effect by needle placement. Or actually, I do quite a bit of laser treatment now, laser acupuncture, so I can even place fewer needles and I can still have a beneficial effect without creating a undesirable stimulation just by having needle go into tissue. But the majority of my patients are older, mobility compromised pets, and they're not going to run away from you as quickly, or they're more willing to be still. They tend to be a little calmer, and so they are overall accepting of treatment. Once they get used to me, and I do a lot of hands-on work that actually kind of calms them down before we start, and then we get an effective treatment done in about an hour or so.
Okay, I want to talk about a couple of issues that are of importance, especially this time of the year. One is, in the summertime, the hot weather and pets, particularly dogs. What do we need to know?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, our dogs are often going out and about with us on adventures, walks to urinate and defecate, or exercise sessions, and so they're going to likely be more susceptible to environmental hazards such as heat and humidity. So certainly we want to, if we're exercising with our pets, we want to first, or if we're about to start an exercise program for ourselves or our pets, we want to make sure that our pet is first healthy enough to exercise, that they're breathing well, that they are comfortable enough to move, that they don't have underlying joint problems that could be exacerbated by activity. But then also want to think about maybe not being overly active in the real primetime heat hours of the day from perhaps 10 in the morning till 5. Or actually in Southern California, it stays hot pretty late in the day too. And certainly when it's more humid out, it's going to put more stress on our respiratory tract. And of course, we never want to leave our pets outside without the appropriate shelter to shade them from the sun and a very fresh water source. And never, ever leave your pet in a car on an unobserved basis. Even if you have somebody to be in the car with them, have your air conditioning on so that your pet doesn't overheat, because they don't sweat like we do. They just lose some moisture through their paw pads and then through their respiratory tract. So they really need to have a much cooler environment in order to keep their body temperature normal.
Well, speaking of paw pads, how concerned should we be with pets in the summertime, in the hot, hot weather, in cities where they're walking on concrete?
Sure, absolutely. Well, if you were to put your own hand down to, or your own bare foot, and you would feel as though it was burning your foot or your hand, it's probably too hot for your pet's paws. Even though the pet's paws are tougher, if you really have calloused heels yourself, you're probably going to not feel the heat quite as well as if you have a nice healthy sole of your foot. But we want to make sure we're not walking our pets on surfaces that our own feet couldn't potentially tolerate. And we experience that here in Southern California year-round, especially in some of the desert communities. Just taking your pet out on the sidewalk or having them walk around your pool, you could potentially really burn your pet's paw and start a whole other series of problems.
When it comes to the heat, should you be more concerned with your dog based on its breed? And by that, I mean, you know, long-haired versus short-haired, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. There are certain breeds that are considered to be brachycephalic, or basically short-headed breeds, brachy meaning short and cephalic meaning head. So breeds like pugs, English bulldogs, boxers, Brussels griffon. These dogs have small nasal openings that don't really move air very well, so they're much more dependent on their mouth to breathe. But then also, they have inherent or inherited problems with how their voice box works to transport air, and sometimes their trachea, their windpipe can be smaller, and so they have this whole syndrome called brachycephalic airway syndrome that inhibits their ability to really move oxygen, and so they're much more susceptible to their body temperature going up because they can't cool themselves down as well in hot weather or during activity.
I mentioned in the introduction that you also have a National Pet Care column. You have a newsletter as well, and I believe this month's newsletter, or the one for the last week of July, had to do with Lyme disease, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Lyme disease is a bacterial disease that's transmitted by ticks, and it's certainly much more common in places when there's a lot of heat and humidity, or at least seasonally, like Lyme, Connecticut, where the disease comes from, for example. I actually was born in East Lyme, Connecticut, and my brother had Lyme disease as a kid. I was able to get out scot-free. But if your dog or cat gets bit by a tick, the blood feeding process allows bacteria to go from the tick into your pet and can potentially set up a disease like Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever or Ehrlichia, all spirochete bacterial diseases that can make your pet very tired acting, possibly not want to eat as well, have muscle and joint soreness. Their body temperature can go up. It can even cause organ system failure. So it's definitely something you want to think about where you go with your pet. Don't take your pet hiking in a very tick-heavy place where they're going to have all sorts of ticks that are potentially latching onto their fur as they graze by. And then use appropriate tick control, either a topical product or some kind of collar that they wear, just to make sure we don't have ticks getting on them and then potentially getting into your household and getting on your family members. Mm.
Is it easy to spot or diagnose? I mean, sometimes, the thing about animals, they really can't tell you what's wrong with them initially.
Sure. And it's best to prevent the disease instead of waiting to recognize that it's happening. And so I think if you're a practitioner and you're working in an area where you commonly see these diseases, you very much recognize them right off the get-go, like the signs that I was talking about. When I would work in the Washington, D.C. area, I would see these dogs come in like an open textbook, basically. So it's fairly easy to diagnose from a history and physical exam perspective. And there's some pretty simple blood testing you can do to confirm your diagnosis. And then you can initiate treatment even while you're waiting for that actual diagnosis. That's one of the good things about those bacterial tick-borne diseases is they respond pretty well to antibiotic therapy.
I mentioned your newsletter and also your column. How do people get the information, and how frequent do you do the newsletter?
Well, I write for a variety of places. I write for PetMD's The Daily Vet, where I talk about my holistic perspective on health or pet news that happens to strike my interest. And I also have a column on Pet 360 called Pet Celebrity News, where I talk about the integration of celebrity pets and health. So there's always some interesting scandal things that are kind of going on there. And then that all filters down onto my website. And that's probably the best way to find me, where you can sign up for my newsletter. And so about three times a week, I post an article about pets and health. And that's on my website, patrickmahaney.com. You can sign up for my blog, email delivery.
Excellent. Patrick, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Again, we should mention your website, Patrick Mahaney, and that's MAHANEY.com, correct?
That's perfect.
Thank you very much for being on the program.
Absolutely, Peter. Thank you.
Veterinarian Patrick Mahaney. Again, you can check out his website at patrickmahaney.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0207, and you'll find links to Patrick's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
In Tempe, Arizona, at around 2 a.m., 24-year-old Ashton Powers walked up to a Tempe patrol car and slashed one of the tires. According to Tempe Police Sergeant Michael Pooley, the officer was pulled over at the corner, finishing up a police report after an unrelated arrest. Suddenly, he felt a jolt and then heard a strange sound coming from his squad car. It was a fully marked police car. The car was running. The officer was inside with the air conditioning on, and you could hear the car running. But that didn't stop him from slashing the tire. The officer jumped out and discovered that his rear passenger tire had been slashed and saw Powers walking away with a knife. The officer caught up with Powers and asked him about it. Powers admitted he slashed the tire, telling the officer he didn't see anyone inside. In this case, police got the last laugh and won for the history books. Said Pooley, "You know this guy isn't very smart at all. It's one of those things we're going to be laughing about for a while." The officer arrested Powers. He is now charged with one count of criminal damage. Okay, any idiot can slash a car tire. And a ballsy idiot might try to do it to a cop car. But it takes a real intellectual titan to slash a cop's tire while the cop is sitting in the vehicle. Now, why would someone do something like that? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0207. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0207. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.